developments up through the next campaign a few months from now, and developments up to the end when we have the all-singing, all-dancing EHT. Is everyone well hydrated? This talk is going to be very dry. But I think it's important because, you know, one of the undercurrents of the meeting, perhaps not apparent to everyone, but probably apparent, has been organizational. And so those of us who've been involved in the organizational discussions, you know, this week and the preceding 27 years, are aware that we're trying to merge many different pots of money and coordinate all of our efforts. And a major aspect of that organization, besides just getting people to sign things, is to create a structure in which we prioritize the things we need to get the array done, and we allocate the tasks that need to be done to actual people who will do them. And so I think what you'll see in this talk is a few places in which there are clear needs, but because they're not clear needs for 2015, the details of exactly who's going to do them and how are not yet settled. But as long as we come into a full organization soon, I think we can work this all out in great time, eliminate any duplication, because we don't have enough people to do things twice, and pull everything together very nicely. So let's see. This slide more or less comes from Ramo's talk. I mean, he emailed it to me and I reformatted it a bit. But basically, I thought it was a good starting point to carry us forward for the details of what we have to have at each site. So in the coming campaign, we expect to have an observing bandwidth of 16 gigabits per second. Perhaps we're capable of doing 32 at over most of the array, but 16 is the target for this next campaign. But of course, the target for the EHT, as Ramo drew with lots of colored circles, is somewhere north of, at least at 64 gigabits per second. And so, to get there, he took us through all of these, he took us through all of these details of settings like this, the LO frequency choices and the IF frequency choices. But there are more details to build ourselves out to that full capability. So there are some things about it that are fairly easy because we've actually had to solve the fundamental issue already for the 2015 campaign. So a great example of that is most of the back-end hardware. You know, when everything was being done with Mark V's and DB, C, C, E, F, 2's, we couldn't possibly have enough rack space to record 64 gigabits per second. With the development, a very rapid development, and Laura Veratsic will talk about that in this afternoon, I think, maybe it's tomorrow, the very rapid development of the Roach 2 digital backend, which was driven by my need to get it to the South Pole this year, we now have the hardware we need. There are things that need to improve on it, but it is perfectly serviceable for getting us to 64 gigabits per second. Similarly, the recording media, thanks to the commercial drive for larger hard drives, is also a solved problem. And so just getting recording and digitizing, we can handle that pretty easily. It's just buying more stuff that we know how to build. To get to 64 gigabits per second, though, we will need to record in both sidebands. And Ramo had his diagram of how we have to match up the IF ranges of the various receivers. That was one of the focuses of some early ETWG work. And to do that well, there are going to be new receivers required. So the LMT is hoping to come into the array very quickly, but doing so with a temporary receiver, in principle, that's a because it's a karma-based receiver, it can cover the IF range we need, but it isn't sideband separating. So you can get a big factor in sensitivity by building yet another receiver, and that's actually a funded development under the MSIP for the EHT. So 2016, we ought to have a receiver of comparable quality to the one that I'll talk about for the SDT at the LMT. Oh, I should have put Gopal's talk on here, but Gopal's going to give us a long talk about the LMT, and what he tells me at this meeting is that the LMT surface is actually looking quite good. And so we can think about using the LMT at 345 gigahertz. And that would be amazing. I've always thought of the 345 gigahertz EHT as, you know, it has real advantages both in resolution, in the opacity of our target sources, we can see further down. But it has the disadvantage of losing sites and losing sensitivity. Adding the LMT back in would be great, but an LMT 345 gigahertz receiver is an unfunded development at the moment. SPT 345 gigahertz is a funded development. The receiver that I'll talk about in my site talk is a 230 gigahertz receiver with an open spot on the other half of the cryostat for 345. And so this year we will install the 230 side. Next year we will hand carry down a 345 gigahertz receiver and drop it in. And then we will have that taken care of at the South Pole. And so that site will be ready for 64 gigabits per second at 345. The JCMT is presently and for some time going to be important for having both polarizations on Mauna Kea. The JCMT 230 gigahertz receiver is not very good. JCMT is being handed over to Asia A management in January, I think. And Asia A makes some excellent mixers. And so I think the prospects for getting, my understanding from talking to people here, the prospects for getting a new mixer at the JCMT that's more capable and more sensitive are very good. APEX, as Remo mentioned, is supposed to have a second polarization at 230 gigahertz by the middle of this year. I'm less clear on the 345 gigahertz prospect, but it's a good site, so it's of interest. To get to 64 gigabits per second, the SMA has its phasing system. Jono is going to talk about that. As Remo alluded to, there are some complications because of the particular IF frequency we have to use. The Plateau de Bure has, you know, its huge expansion with NOAEMA, and associated with that, there's a correlator that I think is going to be the thing responsible for phasing. And so whether or not there's an interim solution will determine how quickly we can really use PDBI to its full capability. Okay. So that is how we get to 64 gigabits per second. Something that Remo said I was going to talk about, and indeed I will, is the question of forming circular polarization. So you might imagine that since most of the talking we do about Sagittarius Star, at least, we talk about its linear polarization, that we would want to observe, do these VLBI observations with linearly polarized feeds. If you've ever seen me give a talk about the polarization of Sagittarius A star, you know that for interferometry, you actually prefer to do linear polarimetry using circularly polarized feeds, because the linear polarization signal is the only thing that comes through when you cross-correlate opposite circular hands. It's even more important, though, for VLBI, because if you have one telescope at this part of the Earth and source is rising, and you have one other telescope at this part of the Earth and the source is setting, then the apparent direction of your linear polarization is different at those two sites. And so rather than correlating vertical with vertical and horizontal with horizontal, you're correlating this angle with this angle, and they're changing over the course of time. If you can convert to circular feeds, then rather than having to deal with this weird mixing of two linear polarizations, which is not even the correlation you want anyway, you just introduce a phase shift between the left and right hands, or between the left hands at two different stations. That's much easier to deal with. At the moment, how do we do this circular polarization conversion? Well, all of the receivers, the millimeter receivers, are intrinsically linearly polarized. They go into square waveguide and rectangular waveguide, and that has it is not a place where you will find circular mode. Most of the stations now, with the exception of Karma, are using hardware circular polarizers. These are birefringent quartz wave plates. In most cases, they're things that I made. There's a picture of one I made for my thesis, but there are many, many more scattered throughout the array. They work, but they do introduce loss, and they have a frequency-dependent conversion between linear and circular polarization, so they're not perfect. It would be better if we could synthesize circular polarization directly in the digital data. And it's especially important, and the ball is being advanced already, because ALMA does not have these circular polarizers. And they certainly are not going to let us go up to 60 antennas or 50 antennas and stick something in the beam when we want to do VLBI. And so rather than correlating circular polarization at all the stations with linear polarization at ALMA, hopefully very soon, and we'll hear about this later today, we can synthesize circular polarization directly in the digitized, the two digitized linear streams. You take one polarization and you take a 90 degree delayed portion of the other polarization and you add them up and you record circular, or you do this in the correlator. Since we're going to have to solve this for ALMA, it seems like it should be expanded to the full array, and the only question is the time scale in which we'll achieve that. Because I think it's a correlator development, I think this is not something we should have to wait too long for. Further on-site specifications. Raimo alluded to speeding up, making our observations more flexible and simpler. It is true that each of these observing runs is an ordeal. For many of us, we have to go to a mountaintop somewhere and sit there for a couple weeks. And it would be nicer and be far more flexible and more nimble in response to the weather if we had a more remote system for triggering VLBI. And so this is something that we definitely need if we're really going to give birth to a millimeter VLBI array capability. I'm not sure if we will do that, but certainly it is something that many people are interested in. And so all the more reason we have to think about this. And so getting this done has been something that's been the focus of, or at least a key point in several of the grants, both in the most recent ATI grant that's funding EHT work in the US, the MSIP grant that really ties together EHT work in the US, the ERC grant in Europe. And so it's pretty clear that one thing we have to sort out relatively soon if we're going to work on this is who's doing what and how we're going to divide up this work. I think it's also worth noting that there are some hardware issues and perhaps some software pieces that would be useful to have at all the stations to make this easier. One example is a standardized low-cost tone injection box. That was something that Jono Weintraub at CFA thought of developing at already, and I'm testing out at the South Pole this year. But if we can cheaply do that and have that be a component of each site without having to buy a second synthesizer at every site, that would also make this go well. All right, what do we have left? Basically a list of things that are going to be talked about in people's talks. So I told you this would be dry. The only picture is already passed. So ALMA phasing is one of the most important things in the entire array. It's what gives us confidence that we can really do this. Mike will talk about this. Obviously, excellent progress has been made on this, but it is ALMA, and ALMA is a $1.5 billion project, and we are not. And so getting permission to use ALMA to do VLBI requires that it be commissioned and accepted, and that process is ongoing. And so while we will do, I hope and expect, and it seems that ALMA's on board for this, test observations with ALMA as early as January of next year as part of commissioning South Pole and commissioning ALMA phasing at some level, we are not allowed to look at Sagittarius Star or M87. And so that isn't going to be a science observation. It's hoped that that commissioning can get pushed out of the way, and maybe late 2015 or mid 2015 or 2016, we can be doing science with a phased ALMA that is there to anchor our array. But Mike will talk about this. Correlators. So it's a huge step up in data from where we've been, where we had three, depending on how you count, four or five stations that were recording at 8 gigabits per second, and we were treating them data in 4 gigabit seconds segments, to 7 or more, 10, 12, who knows, stations recording data at 64 gigabits per second. Fortunately, the correlators aren't reel-to-reel tapes playing back against each other at slightly different speeds anymore. The correlators are based on commercial servers. And so there are two correlators envisioned both for throughput and for expediency in getting future EHT data out. There's one in Bonn and there's one in Haystack. They're both presently being expanded. The thing about this development is that already in 2015, with that long list of stations that Raimo had for our planned experiment, we need to be and recording at 16 gigabits per second. This needs to be working. The system can continue to grow after 2015. We don't need to be able to handle the full 64 gigabits in 2015, but this has to be ready in a few months. And fortunately, it's in the pipeline. The circular polarization formation that I talked about is longer term, but it's a development related to this. And another thing to note, that despite our careful fixing of LO frequencies, we still end up with slight frequency offsets because we don't have infinitely narrow channels in our recorded data. And so correcting for those slight frequency offsets is something we already need to be able to do in 2015. What else? A correlation pipeline and management of the tremendous quantities of data that will be produced by this experiment. They're software tests, and they've both been things that have come up in NSF and DRC grants and perhaps other places as well. This is another area where I think, you know, we'll immediately, upon forming a complete organization, be dividing up this task so that it can move forward quickly. But people are thinking about it and working on it. Getting a little bit closer to science, synthetic data. There are lots of things you might imagine we want that are required for science that will be standard across the array. But synthetic data, I think, is a very special thing. If you have a model of Sagittarius Star and want to create a very high quality simulated observation of it, we need to have some vetted process for doing that. And if you are trying to fit the data to some such model, you need to be able to quickly generate lots of iterations of your data. And so this is different. I think at the moment, while it's been very functional so far, it's fairly crude, the way we do this now. And so I think this is a major task, and I'm glad that Vincent is giving a whole talk about it this afternoon, maybe tomorrow afternoon. But it is, as far as I'm concerned, a real piece of the infrastructure of the EHT, because interpreting data like this requires that we have something we all agree is an accurate representation of our observations. Going beyond these basic things, we can dream a bit more to unfunded things that might be nice someday and certainly would make things better. We've often talked in the past about how we could extend the correlation, the coherence time between sites, if we could monitor the fluctuations of the water above each telescope. The water, you don't know, is the primary source of the changing phase between stations, the non-astronomical phase changes. And so if you can just measure how much water there is above your telescope and convert that to a delay, an atmospheric delay, and remove that, you could slow down the atmosphere, if you will. So water vapor radiometers, ALMA has developed a very nice set of them. Perhaps we could someday outfit all of our stations that don't have such equipment with that and improve our sensitivity and eliminate some of our decoherence. Another thing, for purposes of calibration, Raimo alluded to how difficult that is. I think this is particularly true at the single dish site. At the South Pole this year, I'm deploying an atmospheric monitoring tipper that's independent of our observing. And it will continuously record the atmospheric opacity for us so that we can worry about observing and we can come back after the fact and make sure that we understood how the atmosphere has been getting more or less transparent over the course of the observation. This isn't something that everyone has, but it's something that we could plausibly expand to the array. New bands. So we have targeted the bands that get us to event horizons, 230 gigahertz, 345 gigahertz. The atmosphere is not really conducive to going to higher frequency than that, and there aren't a lot of telescopes capable of doing it, although it would give us higher resolution, and in the case of Sagittarius Star, very clearly let us see a basically unobstructed view of the event horizon with with very little synchrotron opacity to worry about if we could get to, say, 650 gigahertz. But that's not likely to be in the cards. On the other hand, if we find interesting signatures in the time domain, you might imagine that it could be relatively inexpensive to do a lot of monitoring at lower frequency. It's also the case that if we're going to build a global VLBI array that is something one can actually propose to use, like the other lower frequency VLBI arrays that exist, it's a much smaller lift to do 150 gigahertz observations than it is to do 230 and 345. The weather doesn't have to be nearly as good. And so this is something we could contemplate for EHT science and for general VLBI. New sites. I wouldn't have this on here, but Heino, who doesn't drink, I don't think, but had clearly had a lot to drink, was talking to me at dinner about adding new sites and building telescopes on high points in Africa. And certainly it's the case that if we could further fill out our array, not just to improve the UV coverage, but just to increase the redundancy in the Fourier plane sampling and the number of closure triangles that we have, it would be great. So if we're really dreaming about expanding the EHT and expanding to 128 gigabits per second and all that, we can contemplate adding new sites as well. But all of these things are a bit speculative. So in the rest of today and tomorrow, you're going to get talks about many of the things that I've highlighted here. And this afternoon, we have discussions for these things. And you know, maybe we can talk about these and other things that we might dream of doing someday. But that's it for now. Thanks.
Okay, we have time for a couple of questions.
Yeah, regarding new telescopes, it's not only the African telescopes. Just to point out, of course, the Greenland telescope that is being built.
And I was presuming that one already exists.
Yeah, but it's not been on any of the slides. And actually, there's also good progress on a telescope in Brazil, Argentina, LAMA telescope. And so there are sites that are a little bit less speculative.
Okay.
Yeah, another quick question.
It's not a question, just a remark to you and also the previous talk. I think we should also take into account that many of the DBVCs which exist and the RDBE which exist have a tunable mode. So if we could introduce a tunable mode in the next generation R2DBE or R3DBE, that would solve many issues about the LO systems at the different sites. I mean, it's not necessary that each station has to have an identical LO. The normal VLBI operation at 2 gigabit per second already shows that with the tunable personality of the firmware, you can solve many issues of frequency incompatibility.
Well, you do need a common LO if you're going to recover both sidebands.
Yeah.
That, you know, you can mess around with the IF, but you can't mess around with the first local oscillator. But it's true, you can do some
tuning. Let's discuss this offline, yes.
John?
I just wanted to point out that an African South African telescope doesn't just add redundancy, it adds mutual visibility when the far western antennas can no longer see the source.
John and I did a little bit of looking at some African sites ourselves and thought about even Kilimanjaro as a possibility.